This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Want to become the sort of developer top rail shops like Thoughtbot fight over? Join Upcase today to get the pro training, insider knowledge, access to Thoughtbot developers, and a community of like-minded learners you need. Hone core skills like Vim, Tmux, Git, and Rails by visiting upcase.com/halfoff to get 50% off your first month of Upcase. Let's get that junior out of your title and start leveling up today with Upcase.
I had a weird thought when I was like, I'm recording with Sean today. And then for some reason I said, Seanald? Like Donald? And then I just thought of the Seanald, like the Donald. So you're now the Seanald.
Okay. I don't do a good Trump impression, unfortunately.
Okay. Oh, well. That's good, probably. That's for the best. Hello, Sean.
Hey, Derek.
How's it going? Long time no speak.
It's going good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. So since we last spoke, I became an Elixir developer. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Weren't you an Elixir developer last time? Or you were an in-denial Elixir developer last time?
I was interested in Elixir.
No, you were on a project.
No, now I'm on a project. Was I on a project?
Yeah, and you were feeling bad because you felt like you were having to look up too many things, and I was saying that you know as much Elixir as every other Elixir developer at the company.
It's true. So, like, maybe a couple weeks ago, the episode where Lila and I actually kind of dove into Elixir in Phoenix, I was talking about how, like, I'd found a couple small things that I liked better about Rails or hadn't really found any major problems. I don't know if it's today that I'm just working on a harder problem, but so far today, there's a couple things now where I'm like, oh, okay. This is bothering me. Like, what were some of the things that came up? The error messages, just, they're not cutting it for me. Like today, Ian and I were pairing on something and we got an error that was argument error.
Helpful.
Okay, great. I think that came from Erlang somewhere, which doesn't help very much. So the error messages could use some work, I think, to help people out.
So is that still a big issue? Because I remember... Like back in last time I looked at it was something like 0.6, and that was one of the biggest issues, was that there were basically never any error messages, and it'd always just be an issue with pattern matching, expected Atom okay, and got, you know, Atom error or something like that. I know that was something that they were working on improving, but the VM didn't really have any tools to support it. Did they ever get around that, or is that still basically the situation?
I'd say I get some error. I don't know if like that was a specific response to this issue, but I get some errors that are definitely helpful, and I get a lot of errors that are I've learned to decode, right? Oh, this means I did this, or whatever the case may be, and I can't remember any of them off the top of my head. But they're not, you know, it's not really a showstopper, but it's kind of a letdown. I wish they were better. And there's been some that I've gotten, like, clearly somebody wrote an error message into something that wasn't 100% correct. But I wasn't able, like, I don't know enough to know about all the cases to, like, submit a PR myself to say, this would be a lot more helpful if it said this, because I might also be leaving out some other case that the original message was trying to cover, that kind of thing. Like, I'm in a situation where, you know, when I was talking to Lila about it, like, my contributions so far have been mostly, like, documentation and error messages, which is kind of, like, walking the walk of how we talk about how to get involved in open source, right? Like, start doing some documentation pull requests. But sometimes you just don't know enough to submit a documentation pull request. But maybe I should be opening issues a little more.
Issues are always good.
Yeah.
You could also just submit the change, and if it's wrong, then they close it.
That's true.
Or ask you to fix it.
That's true. I should get on that. Other things that are starting to bother me, there's atoms and strings again. We're doing this again.
Yeah.
So like Ruby, you know, we've talked on this show before about I wish that symbols, which in Elixir are called atoms, but they're the same concept. I wish that symbols were just syntactic sugar for like a frozen string. And in Elixir, I just wish they didn't exist. or they were syntactic sugar for a string that you didn't need to quote on both ends or something like that.
Right.
So that just came up a couple times, like in the API that we're working with. It's like, oh, this returns a string, but in this case, it's actually a lot more handy if we don't have to hash rocket everything and we can just use atoms as the keys. So it's got that familiar thing where you're like, oh, this is a map and I can't use this syntax. I have to use this other syntax because the keys are of this type. So that problem's still there because it's very Ruby inspired, probably.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about Erlang and how much of this comes from Erlang underlying it or anything like that. And then the last thing that I often struggle with is the date time stuff that you have to do. So I'm probably going to get this wrong, and people who are listening are going to be like, this is so easy. But like a lot of times, especially in tests, I find myself wanting to use things like a day ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a library for that called Good Times, which is a fantastically named library. So kudos to whoever wrote that. And you can say like good times dot a day ago or whatever, or a day from now, or I forget exactly the exact syntax. And that takes in as its input a Erlang timestamp or date stamp or whatever the case may be, which is a pair of tuples which have like year, month, day as the first pair and hour, minute, second as the second pair, which is a little weird looking when you first look at it. It's a tuple of tuples, I think, is the way it looks.
Right. A tuple of a date and a time, it sounds like.
Yeah. It looks a little weird when you first do it, but it's actually that's not a terrible way to construct an exact timestamp.
You know, other than like a struct of some kind slash object slash record, depending on what language you're working in.
Right. It's not bad. But then basically when you want to go from that to like good time and then back to like something that you're going to persist back to Ecto, you've got to cast it for Ecto's date times. There's a lot of like what format is this currently in? What format do I need it in? And then, what are the intermediate steps that I'm going to need to be in if I want to, like, use, you know, good times to do relative dates, use Timex to parse dates or something like that, which Timex is another date-time library. And I was talking a little bit about this at lunch with people here, and they were mentioning that, like, they kind of laughed, and they were like, you mean exactly like it is in Ruby? And I was like, I guess. Like, active support does a decent job of kind of, like, papering over some of the weirdness with Ruby dates and times.
Well, it also stops being that big of an issue in OO languages because you don't care about what it actually is. You just care about what methods you can call on it, and the interfaces are basically the same.
Yeah, that's true. But there are those weird, they have date and they have time and date time. One of those is added by Rails, right? Date time?
Date time is added by Rails.
Right.
And you should basically always be using time.
Not date time?
Not date time, no.
Okay. So why do we add date time?
Date time is important if you're dealing with certain types of dates that involve calendar transitions. If you care about the specifics of dates that occurred around the time that we switched over to the Gregorian calendar, basically time stores itself as a UTC offset,
mm-hmm.
Whereas date time stores itself as year, month, day, hour, minute, second, and does calendar logic, which basically means it's way slower but is more correct in cases where time didn't advance linearly, basically, or the calendar didn't advance linearly, which happened like a few millennia ago or centuries ago, however long it was.
Something. And then gravitational waves get involved somehow. I'm not entirely sure. Right. Yeah. So anyway, those are the couple things that are starting to like, and a couple times today got bit by things where I was like, you know what would have saved me here? Types would have saved me here.
Yeah. Yeah. As you were saying, like, what do I have? What do I want? What are the transitions? I'm just like, boy, and that really sucks in dynamically typed languages.
And there's a couple other like things that are probably just problems with my editor tooling currently. But like I'm working on this application. Everything's namespace, which is great. We don't have namespaces in Ruby, so fantastic. Right. But I often want to alias things so I don't have to use the full, like I don't have to use like namespace dot account, namespace dot user, namespace dot whatever. I can just, in the same file, if I'm going to be repeatedly referring to that namespace.account, I can just say account, right? So that has, in Elixir, you can do alias, you know, namespace.account, and that'll just let you call it account throughout the rest of that module. And it's really kind of annoying to do that, like to realize you want to do that, like when you're down on line 30 and you're like, oh, all that stuff goes up the top. So you do account, and then you're like, I'm going to remember before I compile this to go back and add alias account to the top. Like that's the kind of thing, like, I know if I were using an IDE, it would probably, like, when I write the file, it would just be like, it looks like you wanted to alias this, and I'm just going to go ahead and do that for you. Because it's, like, the only account in your system. It's in this namespace. You probably wanted to do that. And maybe I could do that with Vim, but there doesn't appear to be fantastic Vim Elixir tooling. From what I can see, a lot of people that are using Elixir are using Emacs. And I don't know if that's actually true, but just from the videos I've watched, a lot of people are using Emacs. And I don't know if their tooling's doing that for them, but
at least a lot of the people making videos.
Right. I still, like, if I were going to start a new project today and I had to be productive immediately, I'd still probably use Elixir and Phoenix right now because it still has my attention. And I still think in the areas where it's different, I prefer it so far. But so anyway, that's where I am. I didn't want to be, you know, the last time that Lila and I recorded, it was all sunshine and roses for the most part. And it still is. Like, I still really enjoy it, but it's definitely some places where I'm like, oh, this is a carryover, and I'm familiar with this problem. So, you know, it's not the be-all, end-all, but
see,
I like it.
My theory with programming languages is that developers don't have languages that they like. They have languages that they dislike the least. And so if you still like a language or framework, it just means that you don't know it well enough yet.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. That kind of like, after that last episode that Lyle and I did about Elixir, Brandon Hickert? I don't know. Sorry, Brandon, if I'm mispronouncing your last name. But he tweeted at me to ask, like, at the end of the episode, I basically said that I didn't know if I was just, like, tired of doing Rails or if it was, like, that this is actually better than Rails and I don't want to do this anymore. And his point was, like, he wondered if it was partly, like, it's the consulting, doing Rails consulting and seeing similar problems again and again and again. And if you are using the same tool again and again and again, the problems you're solving are problems related to the tool. So you become a lot more attuned to the things that bother you about that tool. Whereas if you're continually working on the same product again and over, the tool is a means to improve the product. You do what you're able to do with the tool to improve the product.
Yeah.
And you live with its shortcomings, but you know them, right? And there's some truth to that. And I think there's also some truth to the, like, tools can make certain problems drastically more common, things like that.
Yeah, well, that's part of why I think the consulting background, despite, like, there are members of the core team who don't like having consultants around, basically, because they think that when you come from a consulting background, you see everything as a fire, everything as a problem. But I think on the flip side, right, is that, yeah, I agree, tools can make certain problems more common. And so coming and working on that tool from that background gives a good, I guess, map of things that could be improved and problems that could be made.
Right. Like, a good example is, like, if a feature gets added to Rails that I don't like, if I'm on a product team, I just say, I wish they didn't do that. I wish they didn't spend their time on that. I wish they spent their time on this other thing instead. But I'm just not going to use that. But as a consultant, I immediately think, oh, God, somebody's going to use that, and I'm going to be asked to clean it up. Right? Like,
right. Or on the other side, and I'm going to be asked to fix the bugs.
Right. Sure.
Basically, we can all agree that action cable can just go away.
I mean, maybe it can't go. It doesn't have to go away. It can just be a gem that people can install.
Right. Go away from Rails proper, I mean.
Right. But anyway, there's other things too, like things that come up and I'm just like, oh, I don't want people using that. And if I were at a product team where there was like six or seven people or whatever, we could all just get together and be like, what do you all think about this feature? Maybe we'll try it out in this isolated thing. If we're kind of interested, try it out in this isolated part of the code base. If it works, great. Maybe we can bring it to other places. If it doesn't, or if we all agree on the outset, like, it's not something we're interested in using, we just won't use it. And big deal, problem solved, it's over. But when you deal with a lot of other people's code, you're kind of forced to confront a lot of those issues and see how they get used.
Yeah.
Like, a good example for me was variants from Rails.
Right.
So those are, like, you can serve an entirely different response based on the user agent of the person that requested it, right? So you can say, it looks like this person's on an iPhone, send them this slimmed down markup. It looks like this person's on a desktop, send them this full experience, right?
Well, and you could do that before. This just gives you, because we don't do user agent parsing for you. We just give you a nice API for you to do whatever parsing you want on the request and then call that a variant.
It has some built-in stuff for like when you call render. And
right.
if you have the request variant set, it'll look for the template with that variant.
Right. My point more just being, but it's not like we're trying to specifically encourage serving different markup for mobile, even though that is how everybody uses it, and that's what it was basically added for. Like, Rails doesn't actually do that for you or specifically say, do it that way.
Right. And so, like, for a long time, that came in 4.1, I think, and for a long time, I never saw it. Like, I remember being like, oh, this is, like, can we do responsive design instead and try and, like, be judicious about what we're doing here? And for a long time I never saw it, so I was like, actually, I guess nobody's using this. And then it came along, and it was on a project where I was on, where I was like doing some performance work, and a lot of the performance issues were springing from views. And so I would fix them in one view and then be like, oh, now I've got to switch over to the mobile view, which has the same or maybe a totally different set of problems, and solve them there. So it just, like, created a bunch more work. And I feel like if you knew what you were getting into, and you, like, if you knew what variants were going to do for you and the problems that they might cause from the outset, you would be able to, like, use that feature in a way that didn't cause that problem. But it was only a matter of time before we worked with a team that had that problem, because you might not notice, you might not know until you start using it and see where the problem, like, oh yeah, I can see how that would be a problem. Like, you don't know necessarily the areas to avoid it. But
at the same time, one of the things I've been thinking about a good bit lately actually is that responsive design maybe isn't necessarily always the best option. User agent sniffing to determine what markup to send is kind of awful, and I wish there were, I think there probably is nowadays, a standard way of, in the headers, saying, like, and I am a mobile device of who cares what kind, like, I'm mobile, send me mobile. But simply because, especially if you are somewhere with a poor connection, low bandwidth, or if you have bandwidth limits, right, you're sending way more CSS and potentially way more markup than you need to if you're using responsive design, because they're going to get all of the styles for mobile as well as all of the styles for desktop, and potentially, if some of the markup is being hidden by CSS, also markup that they're not even seeing.
Right. But I think it's possible to have to design a holistic solution that's like one website, one batch of CSS, one batch of JavaScript, and it's still performant. Like, I don't think that that's necessarily impossible. I think
it's
hard.
I'm not necessarily talking about performance. I'm literally just talking about number of bytes sent over the wire.
Right. Well, that's part of performance, right?
Well,
so I guess you
yeah.
could, I mean, if you're talking like super low bandwidth, which you potentially could be talking about, then that, yeah, that is a concern, certainly.
It's more just one of the things that we tend to forget about, and as data caps get more and more restrictive, but especially it's when you get out of the United States, when you have a market that's worldwide, that becomes much bigger of a much bigger issue.
Depends
and you can't rely on
yeah.
everybody to have 4G.
I guess it depends on where in the world, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you get into third world countries like the UK.
Do they have bit slow internet speeds there, or are you just digging on Sam Fibbin?
All of the above.
Okay. Hi, Sam. So yeah, that's where I am on Elixir, and then a little brief tour of the conversation I had with Brandon. So I thought it was constricted to a tweet or five tweets or something like that. So, you know, we didn't get too much context, but I think that captures the spirit of it. What have you been doing the last few weeks?
Well, I was in San Francisco last week to speak at the Bay Area Rust meetup and then talk at a couple of different companies about Rust and Diesel.
Wow. That's
it was
pretty
cool.
Impressive.
I basically worked out of the Mozilla office in between everything, and like people would come up to me and be like, hey, aren't you the Diesel guy? And nobody asked me about Rails all week, and it was awesome. So that was cool. Because as you know, we recently shipped 0.5, which had SQLite support.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a very large undertaking, and I've sort of been taking a little bit of a break since that release. I do need to spit out a really minor release soon, but the next big thing is going to be associations, which are hard. I'm starting to realize that the API that I think I want doesn't actually make a lot of sense in a statically typed language.
What is the API for well, first of all, hang on, how's the SQLite thing going? Like, are people using it? Has it been a problem?
Yeah, people are using it for sure. And it was funny, as we approached the 0.5 release, I'm sure this is just a random coincidence, or maybe it had to do with adoption, but all of a sudden I started getting way, way, way more people asking me on IRC and Twitter and in our Gitter room, like, hey, can I use this with SQLite? From 2 weeks before we shipped 0.5 until we shipped 0.5, just for whatever reason, the number of questions I was getting about SQLite skyrocketed. But yeah, so people are definitely using it. It's not been too much of a problem. There's a handful of features that I still need to add support for. Like, there are features that SQLite doesn't support because I will never be able to support it. Like all of our APIs that rely on using the returning keyword, SQLite has no returning keyword, so we just can't.
So what would the returning keyword do?
So basically, the way it works is if you're doing an insert or an update,
right?
So for things like timestamps, for example, we want you to use the database to update your timestamps and not do that in Rust.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way to get the value of like the new value of updated at is to query the database and any other potential changes that might happen if you do partial updates. So when you're going to update something, you create this update command by doing update some set of records or single record dot set, whatever changes you want. And then on that, you can call either execute get result or get results. Execute will just do it and will return the number of rows that were modified. Mm-hmm. Get result assumes that you are updating exactly one record and will give you back a single record and treats anything that returns a non-zero number of records as an error case. And then get results assumes that you updated more than one thing and gives you back a vector of what you updated.
Mm-hmm.
And then similar to everything else with Diesel, it's built around queries, not models. So when I say you get back a record, that can be basically any struct that matches the shape of the query. Anyway, so and then the same happens for the same API exists for insert and all the same stuff there. And basically none of that works on SQLite.
Okay.
So you can only call execute on SQLite.
All right. Well, that seems okay.
Yeah. And then there's other things like we support batch inserts. You just pass an array of things, and then we do a batch insert. I may eventually figure out some fancy way to do this in multiple queries, but SQLite does not support the default keyword. Like, standalone. Default still exists sometimes when you're saying, like, insert into table default values. But in other backends, you can use the word, just the word default in place of a value. And that says, give me the, you know, use the default value for this column in this one case, which is important if you're doing batch, if you're inserting more than one thing, because if you want to insert two records and one of them, you want the default value and the other one, right, you have a specific value, right? There's no way to do that in a single query.
You need the same number of, you need the same, the tuples have to have the same number of columns in them.
Exactly.
Right. So you need to pad them with defaults where you need the default.
Right. Yeah. So the way you do it in SQLite is you just, you know, you do insert into table, list all the column names, values, and then all the values, and basically just leave off the things that you want to use the default value for in SQLite. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we just don't, so batch inserts just don't compile on SQLite. I mean, the upside to all this is I've got it all set up, so it's not like you get an error. All of this will just fail to compile if you try and do it with SQLite. So there's stuff like that that I'll never be able to support. Or stuff like returning I'll never be able to support. Batch inserts I might change in the future to do more than one query under the hood. Mm-hmm. And then there's stuff that I just haven't gotten around to supporting yet, like our infer schema macro, which is the thing that goes and asks the database for what tables exist and what types all the columns are, and then calls our table macro for you automatically. That doesn't support SQLite yet, just because I haven't had a chance to go in and write that code for SQLite, because it has it, like, none, zero of that code can be reused.
Right.
and then I think the other thing that's missing is I haven't added support for date and time types yet to SQLite.
Okay.
I also didn't add support for the numeric data type. and when I went to go do that, I found that the numeric data type shows no observable difference from a float in SQLite.
Okay. Well then, easy
I'm
implementation.
I'm not gonna add it.
What were you saying? So you said that your earlier plan for associations, you were now thinking you're not going to pursue, or you don't think it's a good fit?
I'm still just, I'm not sure if it composes arbitrarily. I'm still just thinking through all the use cases. But basically, I wanted something semi-similar to includes from Active Record. Although, actually, I guess it's closer to preload in Ecto, where you can pass it a specific query instead of the name of a table.
Yeah, so preload in Ecto, I think you first you get the record back, and then you say preload these other associations off of it.
You can also do it as part of the query builder where you do, you can call preload with an atom, and then it works just like Active Record, or you can also say, like, from C in...
Yeah. We can link to that in the show notes so people can see what we're talking about, but I get what you're saying now.
Yeah, and so I was thinking, I'm looking at maybe doing something similar to that, but the main thing that's different is... The way I want our associations to work is you don't have like a posts method on your user that gets the posts if they haven't already been loaded. What I want it to be is if you get a user and all of their posts, you get back a tuple of a user and all of their posts.
Right. We talked about this a long time ago. Right.
Yeah. And so if you look at how that composes, right, I like to add comments as the third case, because a comment in theory belongs to both a post and a user. Mm-hmm. So if you want a user and all of their posts and all of the comments that user has written, you get back a tuple of user and a tuple of vec post and vec comment.
So you would get back the comments you get back would be associated to the posts already? Is that what you're saying?
No, the comments would be associated to the user.
Okay. But you get a tuple back. Okay, got you. I got it. Yep.
And then if you
a tuple of vectors, you said. Okay.
Yeah, a user and then a vector of all of the posts and then a vector of all of the comments. And the comments are associated with the user, in this case, not with the post. Right? And then on the flip side, if you want a user and all of their posts and all of the comments written on those posts, the return type would be a tuple of user and a vector of a tuple of a of post and vec comment. Right? So tuple of you have a tuple of a post and all the comments on that post, and then you have a tuple of a user and all of those. And if I just start to write out, like, and then if you you compose that arbitrarily, so you can go 5 or 6 levels deep or 8 associations wide, right? And there's a couple of things that I've started to realize. Number one was that I was originally wanting to do it this way because I wanted to enforce that you join whenever you're eager loading associations. And after thinking about it for more than 2 minutes, I realized that if you're ever going to eager load more than one association, it is never a good idea to join it because the data duplication will almost certainly be more expensive than the round trip time.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I started to just write out the API that I was thinking I wanted there, I started to realize that just the return type is utter nonsense. I'm not sure how I get it to arbitrarily compose.
Right. Yeah.
It's one of these things I really need to just write out all the cases I do want to support, all the cases that I don't want to support, if there are any that I know for a fact I don't want to support, and then just write some code that is, here's what I would have to write if I were going to manually do this, and look for the patterns there.
Right.
And maybe once I have 3 or 4 different cases written out, I'll see the commonalities and start to see what the API should be based on that. But it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times when I get into these situations, I like to absorb what other languages and frameworks are doing. And all of the languages and frameworks that have a nice API for eager loading associations are in dynamically typed languages.
Yep. So like the Ecto, when we talked about Ecto earlier, one of the things that we talked about before for a goal for Diesel was to make it impossible to do N plus one queries, right?
Yeah.
So in Ecto, you also can similarly not do N plus one queries, but you still have a method on your object called posts.
Right.
Or on your struct called posts, and it just gives you a not loaded error or whatever.
Yeah.
And you want to specifically avoid having something like that, right?
Yeah.
Well, why would you want to avoid that?
Basically because the posts have to live somewhere,
mm-hmm.
right? So basically what this ends up meaning is if you have a user and you want to sometimes have it with posts, you end up having a field on that struct called posts, which would be some sort of an option or a result, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't scale up. You end up having to have something explicitly there for every single association that you may ever want to load.
That is associated to a user.
Right. Or any model.
Sure. For any given model, any one of their associations has to have an option, basically, that this thing might be there or might not be there.
Right. Basically, one of the things that leads to God objects and Rails would end up being forced to be explicit.
The associations leading to God objects? Is that what you're talking about?
Right. You remember way back on T1D when Code Climate was complaining that we had too many
right. So then we flipped all the associations around, which was perfect.
Right.
I liked
that. And we were like, yeah, this is too many associations. We really shouldn't have user care about this many different things because we're not actually going through user most of the time.
Yeah. So I don't understand why that's a problem for the framework to solve. Like, that's a problem we solved ourselves by just being like, we can get this through the post rather than getting it through the user.
Right.
Right?
Right. My point is that if we get to the same solution, which is that this shouldn't necessarily live on the user. It should be a property of the post or a property of the query.
Okay. I'm still not following. I still don't understand why, like, post couldn't have user as a method on it that tells you what the user is.
So same thing, right? Do you really want to have option user on your post struct?
Why not? If it's
that ends up leading to duplication, unless you want to stick it behind a pointer and heap allocate things. It's just like data associated to with a model isn't part of that model. It is a separate thing.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Like the user ID is part of that model.
Sure.
And that's an indicator of where to go to get how to get the actual other data, I guess.
And my goal is to make it easy to go get that other data if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
But not to make them the same thing.
Right.
Like even if I make it easy for you to go get the user associated with a post, the user and the post are still two separate things, and I want them to continue to be separate things that you pass around separately and have separate ownership.
Yeah, that does make sense. Like just thinking back to Rails and being like, a lot of times when you're dealing with an association through like dot syntax, right? You're like user dot post dot something. Like you have this habit of like when you do a user.posts, you're like, okay, now I'm dealing with a post, but you're not. You're dealing with this association that represents user to post, which is really more closely related to user, but not really. But it's definitely not a post. But sometimes you can call some of the methods on it, and it gets in this weird area. I feel like,
yeah, well, it just leads to muddy logic.
Yeah, definitely. So I can see that.
And it's also just thinking about ergonomics, right? As well, you're never going to end up writing logic that's like, and if I loaded the posts, do this, and if I didn't load the posts, do this other thing.
You could, I guess.
You could, and if you and it's not, but and I'm not necessarily preventing you from writing that if you want to write that. But mm-hmm. the majority of the time, you're either going to you are writing code that assumes it's not there or assumes that it is there.
Right. I'm thinking specifically of like a partial, right, where you're rendering a user's profile. And maybe in some context where you have, like, you could potentially reuse the same partial that would be like, maybe when you hover over a user, it would give you their dynamic basic profile information. And then when you click on it, you get to see like, oh, and here are all the posts they wrote or whatever. And that could actually be the same partial, just saying like, if you have posts loaded, then do this other thing.
Yeah.
I'd be kind of wasteful. Like, you could also just have two partials.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, there are definitely some edge cases where it makes sense. But again, right, like, I'm not necessarily preventing you from writing that code.
Right.
But for the majority case, right, you're never checking to see if you got back a not loaded error in Ecto, nor would you if I wrote associations in Diesel that way. Like, you would likely end up unwrapping that option. Mm-hmm. Wherever you actually assumed that was there. And it's like, if you're always assuming that it's there or not there, I'd rather not shoehorn it into an API where the result is, if you ever make a mistake, you get a runtime error, and this isn't ever checked at compile time.
Right. Having thought about the scenario I just threw out, that's crazy. Don't anybody ever do that. I think I just got vaguely excited by the idea of being able to do that, where like in Rails, you would just be like, user.posts, and then it'd be like, I loaded them all for you.
you can ask in Rails if a relation has been loaded.
Oh, you can. How do you do that?
Dot loaded? Question mark.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. It must use that internally.
Yeah.
For things. And then just
it's public API.
Yeah. Makes sense to make it public as well. Okay. Yeah.
The only method that actually loads is 2A.
And that gets called by various things automatically.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, of course, and then anything that does anything enumerable related delegates to it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, inspect out of necessity needs to load it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Cool. So the idea is you're just going to have to write some code manually and see what patterns emerge at this point?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it's also just I need to distance myself a little. I think I'm being a little bit too influenced also by prior art. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming, like, I need this and this and this. And then I just need to spend a lot of time looking at a bunch of applications in a bunch of languages using a bunch of frameworks and see what people actually do or don't commonly do.
See what people ask for, too. Right? Like,
yeah.
If it's good enough for people to use currently, just see what they start asking you for. And see if you can encourage, like, a different approach to solving those problems and see if, like, I was talking with Ben at lunch today about, I think he was talking about Elm, where he talked, watched a talk with the person who created Elm. I'm not sure. Anyway, if it's a talk, we'll find it. We'll link to it in the show notes. But he was mentioning that this person had said, when you introduce things into, well, in this case, a language, but also a library, shapes how that language or library is used in perpetuity, right? If you introduce a feature from the very beginning, then that is part of its identity, is that it has, you know, part of Active Record's identity is the way it does associations. You can't change the way it does associations without changing how everybody has to think about Active Record. Whereas if you wait and you put associations much later, right, in these automatic associations probably, even if it was implemented the exact same way, probably end up getting used a lot differently because people have already established these other patterns about how to like do association like things that don't involve having has many comments or whatever.
Right.
And that maybe that's not a great example, but like the idea of thinking about when you want to, like, is this absolutely core to it, or is it something I want it to be able to do eventually, and I want to see how it shakes out and how the community solves this problem without these abstractions.
Right.
In place.
Well, when I say association support also, the only case that I'm really referring to is eager loading,
right,
specifically, because mm-hmm. we already have a belonging to method. And you can put belongs to above a class and then you are above a struct. So you can do like post dot belong or colon belonging to and then pass that a user struct. And that all works.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the easy case.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the other thing, right? It's also like, how often do you actually end up eager loading a lot? Like, one of the big questions I'm starting to wonder when I talk about like, well, and this needs to nest arbitrarily. Does it?
Does it? Right.
Like, how often are you actually eager loading more than one level down? It definitely, I would say...
It comes up.
it comes up, but does it come up often enough to really care?
If I can eager load in some other way, then probably not.
Well, I mean, you can always eager load in some other way.
Sure, that's true. If it's simple enough for me to eager load in some other way. Like, in Ecto, for example, I don't know the syntax for preloading a nested association. Like, and when I have to do it, it's like, wait, I got that wrong. I got that. It's, like, complicated. It's not the simplest structure that you have to pass this preload method.
This is kind of the other reason that I want to keep associations separate from the models, is because like if you ever want to do something we don't support, it's never, and then how do I put this into the container that Diesel uses otherwise? It's just you get what you want and then you pass tuples around.
Right.
or whatever structure you want, because I actually don't care.
Right. And so maybe what I was thinking is, like, maybe it's actually kind of a feature that that's a pain in the ass to do. It's like, maybe, you know, you want to do that as little as possible, but maybe not. I don't know. Is it necessarily bad to nest arbitrarily deep? Probably, because you have a lot of coupling, right?
But I think it needs to compose arbitrarily wide.
Right, sure. So you could load many associations.
Right, as long as it's all associated to the same parent.
Right. But then going from, I don't know, post to user to account to preferences or something like that.
Yeah. And again, right, and all of this is, and this is specifically in the case where you have more than one parent record.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So that's one of those, like, do I need that? Things that I'm pretty sure I do like are things like has many through. Not necessarily ever explicitly stating has many through, but more just being able to compose for joins.
To compose for joins. So you
arbitrarily
mean
deep.
Like basically the magic of a has many through in Rails is that there's no magic really. It's like a shortcut for writing multiple joins to get to what you want.
Right. And then, I mean, there is some magic in terms of for eager loading, basically.
Right.
But ignoring that case, right? Like just being able to say, give me all of the comments written on any post written by this user.
Right.
Which you should be able to write nicely when you've already told me, here's how you get from user to post, and you've told me, here's how to get from post to comments.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I definitely don't want it to be the way it is in Rails, where you just say, hey, go get the comments, because that introduces ambiguity. I do want you to have to be explicit. I want you to get the comments through the posts.
Okay.
But
you want it to be easy.
Yeah,
that's something you're gonna want to do often for, you know, the example we gave earlier of like the user profile page.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay.
Anyway, so there's a lot of unanswered questions, and it'll probably be a good bit of time before 0.6 comes out.
How's your web framework?
Good.
When there's a web framework, I'll be there.
Well, so have you seen our new Getting Started tutorial?
For Diesel?
Yeah.
There's a new one? Or
the one on
the website. Yes, I've seen that. Yes.
Yeah, so my tutorial has you build a CLI blog app.
Right, yeah.
Because I tried to use a framework called Nickel for the tutorial originally, and Nickel pissed me off so much that I couldn't finish the framework. I couldn't finish the tutorial.
Okay. Yeah, and plus for a tutorial, you don't want to introduce too many external, like... there's also this hand-wavy Nickel thing. Don't worry. Just copy and paste this code. It'll be okay.
Right.
So to do it, it's CLI block engine. I like that. You could have done a diary, but
I mean,
CLI
that's
block engine.
That's effectively
entry.
What
yeah,
it is.
That's what it is. Yeah.
I guess I never write anything. No, I do write a show. But yeah, I guess I sort of assume that that you're just accessing the same database as a website. And okay. This website apparently doesn't have CRUD capabilities. I don't know. It was a bullshit example, but it was easy, and I got to poke fun at the fact that it was bullshit in the tutorial bit.
And it riffs off of the build a blog in 15 minutes or whatever it was, right?
Yep.
Okay, cool. We should probably wrap up because I got to get back to work. Do you have anything else you wanted to say before we finish up? Hey, we're both going to be at RailsConf.
Yes, we are both going to be at RailsConf.
You will be speaking about Rails 5.
Yep.
And the lesser publicized features of it. Right?
Correct.
All right. So I'm excited about that. And I, along with Richard Schneeman and Caleb Thompson, are going to be giving a workshop on upgrading to Rails 5. The idea being, I believe, that there's going to be an app we'll go through. And then if there's time, maybe you can start upgrading your own app. And we'll be there for the length of the workshop to answer questions.
And if I've done my job properly, it should be a very easy workshop.
Well... yeah, we'll see. I haven't run into too many active record issues. And it all comes from, I actually found that, we can do a Rails 5 episode someday, but what I've found is like a lot of what I'm having to change when I'm trying upgrades is stuff that it's cruft that I've learned since like Rails 3 that actually I never got around to learning that there was a better way to do it in Rails 4. And now that way, the Rails 3 way is totally gone or something
right.
like that. So... it's not a big deal.
We did finally decide that we're just going to leave. I might be mistaken on this, but if I recall from the conversations that I think I'm recalling, we did finally decide that we're just not going to get rid of before filter.
Hey, after I just committed a bunch of code to clearance that's like if responds to before action, then before action, else before filter.
I mean, it never hurts to future-proof, but...
well, the idea being I am like, just for this Rails 5 upgrade of clearance, I'm just like, I don't care. Just get it in there because the very next release is going to be dropping support for Rails 3 and I guess four, everything up to 4.2 probably. I'll probably keep 4.2 supported.
Yeah.
And Ruby 1.9 and Ruby 2.0, which just end of life today. So I think today, sometime recently. So that's exciting. I'm very excited to get that done.
Wait, so you're dropping support for Ruby 2.0?
I will be in the next, well, not in the next release, but in the next major release, which is going to come immediately after, hopefully immediately after, whenever Rails 5 ships.
Nice. I really wish Ruby Gems let you actually express your supported Ruby versions in your gem spec.
You can.
You can now?
Yeah. So I could, I was wondering about this, like, would you consider that a breaking change if I said, if just in the next point release, I said, this gem doesn't even exist for versions less than 2.1. Is that a breaking change? Because it would be impossible for you to break your app because you would not be able to install this gem.
Right. That's a good question.
I'm not going to do it at this point. At this point, I'm just going to wait. But it feels like if you just changed, I don't know.
have you looked at the Rust API evolution policy ever?
I don't think so.
It's basically, right, because Semver doesn't actually specify
what a breaking change is.
What a breaking change is, yeah. And so this is basically what we consider a breaking change. And it's interesting because the rough guideline is we separate things into major and minor breaking changes, and like minor breaking changes can go in minor releases. And a minor breaking change is basically something that like isn't strictly an API change and is something that would otherwise, like in other languages, would probably not be breaking change. And basically, the better way to put it is anything that the user could forwards compatibly prepare their code for.
Sure.
So things like, because technically introducing any function that is any new public item anywhere is a breaking change, because if they're glob importing your module, there can become a namespace conflict.
Yep.
But they could forwards compatibly not, or prepare for that by not glob importing.
Sure. We'll review that. And then I will also look forward to dropping support, probably in a major version bump. I don't know. I guess like the only thing I can think of is like if then there's an actual bug that's discovered, right? So I release 1.13 or whatever the next version is, and I drop support for whatever, the old Rubies and maybe some old Rails versions. So they just don't install on those versions. But then an actual bug gets discovered. So I release 1.14 and they want to fix that bug, but they can't even install 1.14, even though it's supposedly like major version compatible.
1.13.1.
Right, well, I'd have to go back and apply that, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing I would have to do if I wanted to support 1.x users if I bumped to 2.0. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, cool. We should wrap up.
Yep.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/54.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any other episode, you can tweet us at @bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.